Good morning. I'd like to welcome everyone to the October 16th, 2017 meeting of the Chelan Public Utility District Commission. We've got a great audience today. Mostly staff members, but I do notice that we have a visitor or two anyway, so that's great to have you here. Since these meetings are recorded, I'd like to remind everybody that if you desire to speak to any item on the agenda today, we ask that you please come to the table and use the microphone and state your name and address for the record. That would be much appreciated. Also, would like to remind everybody that we appreciate it if you will silence your cell phone, and I'll double check just to make sure I've done mine. It's a good thing because it wasn't. And again, welcome. And this morning we'll meet with a study session. This afternoon we have a business session. And there was something else I wanted to mention. All five of our commissioners are with us this morning. Commissioner Congdon is with us by phone. And we have a new face at the board table. The new clerk of the board and executive assistant to our general manager, Rebecca Garfine. And welcome aboard. Yes, great to have you. And she's being trained by our most capable interim clerk of the board, Teresa Boucher, and it's great to see both of you sitting here at the table. Yes. And before we go any further, I'd like to start with a Pledge of Allegiance and a Safety Minute led today by Doug Lewis.
Thank you. I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America. Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
It's all mine, huh?
You bet.
All right. How many in the room have had a teenage driver? Okay. I'm on my sixth.
Oh, wow.
And final teenage driver, age 16. Today, starting today and for this week, is National Teen Driver Safety Week. Didn't know if anyone knew that, but it is. And just for some statistical purposes, 6 out of 10 teen crashes involve driver distraction. Last week, my wife was driving to work, and this is our car. We no longer have a Subaru. It's been totaled. And it was a young lady, about 17 years old, who had a couple of friends with her. And she was reaching down to get her makeup off the floor and barreled into my wife. Well, barreled into the car at about 30 miles an hour and totaled both cars. My wife's fine. She took a day off of work, and now we're on the hunt for a new car. Unfortunately, the young lady is going to have some repercussions with that. According to Washington state law, she will be cited, and she'll get mark number one on her account or whatever with the DOL. And if she gets another ticket, she actually will be her license will be suspended for another 6 months. Or if this is a third infraction, as she actually will lose her license until she's 18. Those are some of the rules that they have now. Don't know if you knew this, but 16-year-old drivers, when they start up, they're limited to the hours that they can drive during the day. They are not allowed to drive between 1 a.m. and 5 a.m. for good reason. They have restrictions. They can only have family members in the car for the first 6 months, and after that you can start bringing in the friends, and that's where the problems really start. But they're distracted by so many things. You know, they've got the radio going or an earphone in. They've got obviously makeup, got to eat, got to drink, all these things that you can't do anymore. They've made some rules. Washington State's actually made some rules recently that I'm sure some of us are having a hard time breaking too, the eating and drinking, maybe for most of us. But the teenagers, and we've received letters in the mail from the state saying your kid got a ticket, next time it's going to be worse. Just if you have any influence over a teenager at this point in your life, and you probably have a teen driver now, you know, we do our best when we're teaching them how to drive. You know, I've done my best, and, you know, I had all boys, so it goes from this to 70 miles an hour pretty quick once they're behind the wheel by themselves. But you hope that they can behave and not break too many laws and just keep things under control. So I would encourage all of you, whoever has access to a teenager, whether it be your own or another one that you have influence over, encourage them to obey the rules and keep us all safe. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Doug. And just have to make an additional comment. In our neighborhood, we had a couple of years ago a young lady that turned 16 the first week of April, and the second week of April proceeded to put her car into a stubbed off power pole that was being used as for the mailbox, but it was still in the ground. And she had been checking her makeup in the mirror, and the only reason anybody knew anything about that was because her brother was with her. And so it was a single car accident. And we're finding that community, I won't call it humiliation, but harassment about that, you know, been putting on your makeup at home lately, you know, it helps.
Yeah.
It does, yeah.
A little bit of humiliation.
Yeah, the benefit of a small community is one of our sons was speeding excessively on a city street and hit the end of the cul-de-sac and realized that was kind of abrupt, so he had to go back through the neighborhood he had just terrorized. So he's going back through, and this person steps out from behind a parked car and flags him down and says, when you get home, let your dad know I'm calling within a half an hour. And I taught you better in my driver's ed class than to do that. So it's helpful to have a community that's also out there on your behalf. So it's good to live here.
I appreciate getting calls when my son has done something inappropriate in a car, and I have got those calls from people I work with.
Yeah, I'm grateful he came straight home and said, you're going to get a call.
Yeah. Okay. Great memory, a reminder of your moment.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Yeah. Appreciate it, Doug.
Yeah, now it's the grandkids getting their license.
Item two on our agenda is the approval of the agenda, and at this point in the agenda, we can, as a commission, move any items that are currently on the regular agenda to the consent agenda. We can take up, if any member of the public has an item that they wish to have considered, we can consider whether or not that can be placed on the agenda. We do have a very full agenda today. I think we're all aware of that. So at this time, are there any of the items on the regular agenda that you wish to have moved to the consent agenda? It's been recommended, by the way, that we move 11, 12, 13, and 15 to the consent agenda. Would that meet with the approval of everybody on the commission?
Yes.
Okay, so that will just leave one regular agenda item, resolution number 14, for the regular agenda. All right. Balance scorecard update. This is a commission item, and the first key indicator, and I know Commissioner Congdon is on the phone and indicated there's really no change in her first one, that we've had very few Mid-C meetings this year, and we have one. Do we have one coming up before the end of the year, Mid-C?
Mm-hmm. November. It's in November.
That's the
Is it the 14th?
13th or 14th.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's 14th.
Yeah. So if we have good attendance there, we should pull ourselves back into the green on our attendance. And looking down to the additional items, Commissioner Bowles, you're in charge of the district budget review?
Yeah, and I'm under full impression that our finance department is preparing the budget and will be done in the appropriate 13. Time frame, and we can adopt that by the end of the year.
You think we're going to have a budget by the end of the year?
I really believe so, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, full faith and credit.
Okay.
Kelly's smiling at me, so... I assume that's approval.
Okay.
Yeah.
And Commissioner McKenna, you have Energy Northwest.
Right. And we're 75% on that, and that will be changing this month as we head down to the Tri-Cities.
Mm-hmm. Yep. All right. I think there's three of us going to the Tri-Cities, I believe. So, and then the last item, which is, again, Commissioner Bowles, and that's the very last item on the second page, review and update of the training program for newly elected board members. Do we do that on an annual basis, or is that?
Just when we have a new commissioner.
Right.
And I have not had the conversation yet with Steve as to whether he has felt that that's been adequate, or with the other commissioners who have seen something that they think we ought to improve on. So I would welcome those conversations. From my perspective, it's been done, you know, and done well, but I think we need to review that to ensure that. And I'll take care of that.
All right.
And as the new person, it's been done well here, and it's also been done well at Wapoota on the statewide level as well.
That's good feedback. That's very good feedback.
Good. Yeah. So I would say we're okay there.
All right.
I've had my conversation.
Okay. Item 4, 2018 budget.
Okay, invite Craig Koontz and Deborah Vaughn up to take the next step where we move from the five-year business plan to the 2018 look.
Good morning, commissioners.
Good morning. Good morning.
I'm Craig Koontz, Senior Financial Planning Analyst, and with me is Deborah Vaughn, Strategic Financial Planning Analyst. Give Deborah credit, she does the lion's share of a lot of the work that we are going to present today. And welcome to the kickoff of the 2018 budget season. There'll be no
Was right.
Yeah. There'll be no figures presented today. It's just information on the timeline and key assumptions. So we'll cover the purpose, the timeline, assumptions, and next steps, and there are no board action required today. Now, the primary focus of the budget is transitioning from the business plan's five-year look to a one-year focus for 2018. And I'd like to start by connecting to the overall planning cycle to help us get our bearings on how we each fit into this process. The common question in strategic planning is, where do I fit in? Well, this slide shows how the planning cycle cascades through the organization. We start with the vision and mission, which leads to the strategic plan and district-wide priorities. This in turn leads to the district-wide five-year business plan, which cascades to the business unit five-year business plan. So here we are right here. This is focusing on 2018 of the five-year business plan. From here, we develop district-wide annual performance plan, department work plans, and annual employee performance plans. Looking at the 2018 budget timeline, in September, business plans were finalized and the budget process was initiated. The business plans were presented on October 2nd, which established the five-year plan. The current focus is on establishing department spending budgets and corporate budget details for 2018. We will present the 2018 details, the facts, and the figures to the board in two public hearings on November 6th and November 20th, and then request formal approval on December 4th. The foundation of the plans and budget is the top of our balanced scorecard, customer owner satisfaction. Our highest priorities are investing in assets and people, followed by debt reduction and the continuation of the public power benefit program. Looking at some 2018 district priorities, and a lot of these will look familiar based on the 10-2 presentation about the business plan. The difference is the last meeting we focused on the five-year priorities, and now we're focused on just 2018. And some highlights include completing the Rocky Reach large unit repairs, continuing modernization efforts at Rock Island, upgrading our customer information system, and continue to develop employees to achieve safety goals and operational excellence for high reliability operations. These are some additional district priorities that were shown on the 10-2 presentation. And here's some further priorities, including paying down debt, following our debt reduction plan. I would note the review of the planned $85 million reduction for 2018 is underway, and would like to highlight that the $61 million of the $85 million reduction is optional, which means that we're going to pay down at least $24 million in 2018. We're on a path to achieve the 2019 debt ratio target of less than 35%, and we will continue the public power benefit in 2018.
Quick question there.
You bet.
If we chose the option to not pay down the 61, would we still be on that target to be less than 35%?
Yes.
Okay.
By 2019.
By 2019.
Yes. Looking in early external indicators, many of these external indicators are subject to change and may be unknown at this time. But what we see is the continued low wholesale electric market prices continue. We are focused on investing in projects with the highest long-term customer value, and we are following the changes to load growth patterns and customer profiles. This is looking at our 2018 targeted financial policies, very similar to what we've had in the prior years. I would note that the days cash on hand target of greater than 250 days is presented in this slide, which is new from the 2017 budget presentation.
How many days do we have on hand right now?
I would say greater than 500.
Okay.
And looking at some key budget assumptions, I'm going to highlight a couple. The wholesale revenue, we assume average flow conditions, as it's early in the, we're still in 2017, and the current forward price curve look. We assume a 2% electric load growth. That's net of conservation efforts. We assume a 2% water growth and a 1.5% wastewater growth. And we assume approximately 1,000 fiber new premises passed. I would note there's no electric rate increases in the 2018 budget assumptions, but we do have a 2% increase in water rates and a 5% increase in wastewater rates, which follows the multi-year plan approved by the board in 2015. Another key budget assumption includes labor assumptions. I would note that the collective bargaining agreement expires on March 31st, 2018, and that wages and benefits associated with this bargaining unit employees are to be determined and will ultimately be reflected in by the agreement in the budget. Non-bargaining unit labor includes assumptions for merit increases, market adjustments, and promotions, but the final decisions will be informed by actual market data during a formal process. Looking at our long-term plus power contracts, the debt reduction charge and the capital reduction charge are at 3% and 50% respectively, which remain at the maximum amounts. We are also assuming that Alcoa restarts Wenatchee Works. This is the most conservative assumption for the 2018 revenue.
If I could just reinforce, we really are not trying to predict what will happen there. We just chose what would be the most conservative revenue assumption for us.
Continuing on with key budget assumptions, the capital and operating expenditures are driven by the 2018-22 business plans. And the 2018 expenditures are our planned peak, as this will be a big year for Hydro's work, including Rock Island B1 through B4 repairs, Rocky Reach large unit repairs, and we're doing a lot of investment in distribution infrastructure. As I mentioned earlier, we will continue with our planned debt reduction and implement the public power benefit program. The public power benefit program has been earmarked in the 2018 budget, and budget revisions will be processed to allocate any newly designated projects within 2018. So looking at the next budget steps, we'll be having budget hearings on November 6th and the 20th with detailed figures and facts, and we will be requesting board approval on December 4th. Any questions?
Any questions?
Pretty clear.
Good presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Just like to add one other quick thing. So we are on a path to completing the five-year business plan. So we have not received any public comment. The comment we received from the board was supportive of the initiatives that have been identified there. So just wanted you to know kind of final chance here where we, before the next board meeting, completing the, and posting those final business plans. Without objection? Good, thank you.
All right. Water and wastewater update.
Laybot, presentation.
When was it again? Morning, everyone. Ron Slaybaugh, Water Wastewater Manager. Here just to provide an update on a few things that are going on within the Water and Wastewater Utility. Information only, of course. No action required today. Those three items are update on our Upper Skyline Reservoir Replacement Planning, the Regional Water Second Source Planning, and Lake Wenatchee Wastewater Plant. Upper Skyline Reservoir was one of the, or is one of the remaining pieces of infrastructure that we acquired when we entered the water business back in 1974. It was analyzed in our most recent comprehensive plan that the board approved back in earlier this year. Due to its structural condition, it's approaching the end of its useful life, and it's one that we've identified for replacement. Most obvious choice would be just to replace the reservoir on its existing site, but in analyzing that particular site, it's up by Saddle Rock Mountain, south of Skyline Drive up on the hill. We own a piece of property that's surrounded by the land trust property. We think that there might be some reasons for us to consider an alternate site alternate to that. The access is very difficult to that particular site. We can't get to it easily year-round. Certainly some aesthetic considerations, and also looking at the pressure zone that that reservoir serves, there would be an advantage if we could find a piece of property, for example, up number 2 Canyon. We could certainly alleviate the aesthetic considerations, provide better access, and bolster the fire flow up number 2 Canyon without a significant increase in cost. Planning level, looking at the two sites, we feel that the fully loaded cost to construct a new tank is within plus or minus 10%. So it feels worthy at least to look up number 2 Canyon. We could bolster the fire flow from the existing less than 700 gallons per minute up to approximately 2,000. So where we are right now in the process is just to evaluate availability of suitable properties. Of course, we're limited. We can't go. Not every piece of property would be suitable for us. We're limited by elevation. We have to construct it roughly the same elevation. So that's where we're at in the process right now. Okay, regional water. This has been ongoing for several years. Regional water, of course, provides water for us, City Wenatchee, East Wenatchee Water District. We're serving roughly 75,000 people, and that's expected to grow to over 100,000 by the year 2040. Regional has been looking at this for quite some time, and we evaluated several alternate sources in a report a couple of years ago. Right now, although the water that comes from the East Bank Aquifer is of very high quality, it is just a single source. And we're looking to serve over 100,000 people. If we can find a second source that is of similar quality and quantity, that would be advantageous for the communities. The previous analysis identified a groundwater supply down, surprisingly, by our Rock Island Dam in Chelan County. And the preliminary analysis typically involves some just hydrogeologic evaluation of soil types to try to quantify what the aquifer could provide, and looking at existing wells in the area. And we're optimistic that there could be a pretty good supply down there. So the next step was to drill a test well, which we did earlier this year. Unfortunately, the results weren't so good. We're hoping to get out of a 10-inch well something over 1,000 gallons per minute with minimal drawdown, and we got right at 300 gallons per minute with a lot of drawdown, almost exposing the pump screen. So we certainly did not find what we were looking for at that site. Still looking at all the data that's available. In the original report, there was an alternate site that was also identified at Rock Island that could work for us. We'll need to take a look at that and see if further evaluation of Rock Island is warranted or if we move on to one of the other sites that were identified in that report. So more to come on that later.
So, Ron, to give us context, currently on a sustained basis, what is the need of the three districts, Wenatchee, East Wenatchee, and ours, on a gallons per minute basis?
Well, on an annual basis, acre feet, it's about 11,500 acre feet. Mm-hmm. Gallons per minute varies considerably depending on the season and on the day.
Okay.
Yeah. So East Bank has the water right is good for 13,277 acre feet, and we're using 11,500 roughly of that right now. And even though there's been some population growth within the communities and system growth, the demand on East Bank hasn't increased considerably just due to conservation primarily. It's been pretty flat over the last 6 to 10 years. So we have some time.
Okay.
Next, the Lake Wenatchee Wastewater Plant. We completed an upgrade to that plant earlier this year. This is one, the original facility was constructed by the Forest Service for their needs. I believe it went into service in the early 70s, 73 or 74. We took that system over when we extended the collection system and service around both South and North Shore Lake Wenatchee in 1993. The plant, what you see in this first photo here, is actually the lagoon. And these lagoons back in the 70s were constructed with a PVC liner with a 20-year anticipated life. So you go from 74 to 2017, and it's a little bit over double that. Downstream of the lagoon, we have a spray field that we discharge treated effluent to, and we're starting to see some elevated nitrate levels in the shallow groundwater under the spray field. And looking at the history of the plant, performing an engineering analysis and discussions with ecology, we felt that the most likely source of that nitrate was from that liner in that lagoon beginning to leak. So the three photos that you see here, one is removing the biosolids out of the lagoon that accumulated for roughly 40 years. Second is the lagoon bottom all graded out with cover soil ready to accept the new liner. And the third, of course, is the new liner just right before we put it into service. There's a few other upgrades that were made in addition to this, primarily to electrical and control systems to improve the reliability of the facility, replace some aging equipment. Total project cost was just under $1.3 million. And this took care of the treatment plant. We have that collection system around Lake Wenatchee also. It's pressurized pipe, and we have about 200, give or take, septic tanks that are at the various homes and businesses in the state park. And the equipment within those, we have pumps and control panels that is aging as well. So this next year, we want to perform an inventory, get an analysis of that collection system, and develop an improvement plan for it as well.
Okay. Ron, does the new liner have the same expected life, or is it a longer life expectancy?
It's longer. The new liner is a high-density polyethylene, and they're three or four times thicker than what the old polyvinyl chloride liner was. Any other questions?
Questions for Ron? Thank you. Good update. Right.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Next up, we want to give you some information about diversification of energy sales as we think about potentially increasing sales to retail loads. So Andrew Cassell has been working with the port to provide an update.
Good afternoon, or I guess it's morning still. So today I'm here to provide information on a project we've been working on. In 2018, we'll look to see if there's a role for new large loads, subject to our Schedule 4 rates. I'll go into a little bit more about that later. And diversifying our energy sales. This will be a multi-phase approach with scheduled go-no-go points between phases. And so it's not any decision being made. And this is to inform the board on what's going on and what we've been working on. So today I will provide the backdrop behind the concept, what's really leading us to look at this, why are we looking at this, and then that will lead to a discussion on why and what has happened, what we are planning to do. And then finally, what has been accomplished to date. There's been some work, especially in regards to discussions with stakeholders, very important in this process. And then some next steps, both near term as well as into the next year. So there's a lot of information on the slide, but this information really acts as a backdrop behind the what and the why we are looking to accomplish. A large proportion of our revenues come from market-based and large cost-based power purchase agreements. These, the revenues from these keep our local rates low and help subsidize them. These revenues support our local rates, and over the last several years, we've been seeing a decrease in market sales, just as was shown in the last in the presentation from Craig on finances. This could continue on, and due to a number of factors, including fracking, natural gas, which is a decrease in natural gas prices, California, what's going on there has been a big driver. And so what we don't know is whether those drivers will continue or whether they'll stop. And so we would also like to see if we can use some of this low-cost renewable energy that we sell to the West through these some of our larger contracts, see if we can use those to support our local economy. While also protecting against some of this continued downside risk. And that gets into ability to use a Schedule 4 rate, which I'll talk to in just a minute. So why diversify? Our current sales are really on two sides of the spectrum. We have thousands of customers on our retail side, and we have a few really large customers on our wholesale and cost-based contract side. And there's nothing really in the middle. And there's an opportunity to look at that middle area, greater than 5 average megawatts, to see if there's some sort of opportunity there to both help provide some protection against the low side prices, while also supporting our local economy. And these Schedule 4 rates, we can look at the. They're flexible enough so that we can look at the impacts of customers that could be coming in, look at what those impacts are, and then make prices accordingly. And so they can be market, or they might go cost based, but there's something in that area. And so their work is being done on those right now. So that's kind of why, when we talk about, when we talk about new local loads, it's not new local loads that are subsidized prices. It's something different than that, and it's something that we have a rate already in place for. So, but whenever you have this, these potential upsides, you also have downsides to it as well. If the market goes up, we could lose on the opportunity to capture some of that value going upwards. Also, when you bring new load in to the system, you can also increase, stream flow risks, outage risk, credit risks, and those sorts of things. So all of those questions will have to be factored in. And then our ancillary benefit, of course, includes supporting the Chelan County economy, which is consistent with some of the customer surveys that we received during the strategic planning process. How can we, within our statutory authority, where we benefit the utility and the economy, are there ways that we can do that? So from a high level, this is what the schedule looks like, including go, no-go points. Under a broad stakeholder engagement umbrella, we are working on two phases. One is the first phase is a local infrastructure assessment, and this is in this area right here. And really what that's doing is going out, looking, is there land available for potential companies to come into? And if so, what's there? What are the attributes that are there? What kind of power is there? What kind of water, wastewater? What's the zoning? What's all this information available that's there? So in a simplified way, really what we're looking at the end of this process is, a table that has properties, and then within each columns, you've got, is there power, is there water, is there wastewater, is there fiber, and all these sorts of things, so that the company comes in, you can go, well, what are you looking for? And then you can have that information available. And in phase two, if it looks like there's something out there that makes sense for us to continue, phase two would look at developing a market and recruitment strategy, and that would be working closely with the port and other economic development entities in the area to go and say, hey, we have this kind of property available with this kind of infrastructure there. Should we, or what type of companies would best be suited for that? And so you're focusing your efforts on something what you actually have available. So instead of, you know, some company asking, hey, do you have 800 acres available? Well, no, we don't have 800 acres available, so that might not be the right, that could be the answer to that. And so it's really working for that. And so, you know, once we get past that point, then we would look into working on this, working on putting this together. And then at the end of that, there'd be another point and say, okay, now do we really want to move forward with something like this? Because there are some other, unintended consequences to actions, and we want to make sure we think through those before moving forward. And so that is what these two areas are really intended to do, is to get through a phase of work, step back, does this make sense? Do the next phase of work, step back, does this make sense? And then decide if we want to move on. And this is just a more detailed look at the steps, the stepwise approach of what's going on. Some of this work has been done. You know, I've been working, as you'll see a little bit later, I've been working with some of the local entities to discuss this project with them, see what we can do. I do want to point out, we've got these two decisions here. We do have a stakeholder engagement on the side, that's working through both phases. And then there is this potential Board of Commission policy decision or discussion, at least, in this area. And this work could lead to a policy question associated with how and when infrastructure is installed. The range of options could be, status quo, kind of what we do now, all the way to a build that they will come. So do you set aside a piece of land and say, hey, we're going to make a choice to do something. Now, this isn't a decision that needs to be made now. It might not even need to be made at all, but it is out there, and it is a question that come up, and we wanted to make sure that we, provide lots and lots of opportunity and lead time before something like that could come up. And so that's really the important takeaway on this slide here, is that there is a potential there. There is a question there, and so we want to make sure that there's plenty of lead time with that. I'll stop there. We've gone through a little bit here. I'll stop there and see if there's any questions before I move on.
Questions?
So Andrew's just looking at kind of the concept of an industrial, what is known as an industrial park,
mm-hmm.
And or one-off pieces of property, kind of a combination.
It could be. I mean, I think right now it could be. Right now, this first phase is to see what sort of land is out there, and then next, after that, you could see, well, should this be a park or should it just be one large, is one large entity you want to come in, or should it be a park with, multiple, maybe like 5 average megawatt users right inside that park? It could be a number of those. So I don't think that decision hasn't been made.
Okay.
So.
But those are all in the realm of possibility.
Yes.
Absolutely. Okay.
I think it makes sense to be able to try to focus people into certain areas, from a planning perspective and also all those sorts of things.
Additional questions?
Oh. It's just a little bit of work to date. I did want to just focus in on, I have spoken with the county, cities, Port of Chelan on this project, this concept, very supportive. Actually using, both their staff as well as utilizing the Tri-Commission sponsored planning group. So I've tried to leverage that group as well that's out there. And really a lot of support working with the port on, they're actually doing a project that I think we can leverage off of. They're starting it right now. And so I'm working with them to see if we can, add on to theirs, to their project if need be. And that's in the next steps. So really looking at what their project is, determine the similarities and gaps, and if there's gaps from their deliverable, can we add a little bit of funds to get our deliverables taken care of, and then we have one bigger project that is much more, that's done more efficiently since, we'd be adding on to theirs. So. Now we'd look to, if that's the case, we'd look to be contracting with our consultants, and then 2018, initiate and complete the infrastructure assessment, and then pending a go-no-go decision, we would look at developing some sort of marketing recruitment strategy. This would lead to another go-no-go decision at late Q4 or maybe even into 2019. Those dates aren't, you know, set in stone, but that's really sort of the outline of what we're looking at doing. I think this will be a discussion at the Tri-Commission meeting as well.
Yes.
So we wanted to make sure we got that to you as well, too. So.
Additional questions? Looks like a worthwhile exploration. I think that's what you call it at this point, is an exploration?
I think it is, yeah. We're seeing what's out there and what's available. And also, too, even if we get through the infrastructure piece of it and we have this deliverable, even that would be great to, you know, everyone in the county that's associated with this kind of work to be able to have a one worksheet that they can talk off of. You know, here's what we've got. This is what we've got going on. So that when, you know, a company comes in and either comes and stays or comes and goes, at least they can look at our area and go, wow, they've got their, you know, they're all coordinated. They're working well together. And so in that, I think it will bode well for us in the future, too.
Yeah, Mike. The question behind my question, or the information behind the question, was Eastern Washington's university's urban planning classes used to bring field trips to the local area to be involved in looking at what not to do. And if we have an opportunity to be a part of growing this community in Chelan County in a desirable format and a cooperative way that fulfills a future vision that's agreed upon, it would be good for us to be involved. So I just don't want field trips coming here.
What not to do.
Additional questions or comments? Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
I think you can basically look at this as increasing our options as we see the wholesale market decline.
Yeah.
It's a good hedging strategy. Next up, we want to talk about Arundel River Park. Miss Michelle Smith to represent, and we have a special guest today, too.
These already have tracer.
Boy, once that cat's out of the bag, it's tough one to put it back.
And good morning, Commissioners. Jeff Smith, Managing Director of District Services.
This is Michelle Smith. Sorry about that. Michelle Smith, Director of License Compliance.
And I'm Lisa Park, the Executive Director of the Port of Douglas County.
So we are here today to discuss the future of Arundel River Park and seek some direction from you. We are not asking for any decisions to be made today. We thought we'd start with some context that will help with our discussion. The park is located on the Douglas County side of the Columbia. It's just upriver from the community of Arundel. It's a five-acre site that is jointly owned by the Douglas County Port District and Chelan PUD, and it's operated through an agreement with the Port District. The park is part of the PUD's recreation plan, or Exhibit R, for the Rocky Reach federal license. And at this point, we're going to turn it over to Lisa to talk a little bit more about some elements of the presentation.
Great, thank you. One second here. There it is. Find the right one. I had to find the right version. So thank you for the opportunity to come and talk with you a little bit this morning. This project is something that I've been working on with the PUD staff since I actually started with the Port of Douglas County in 2011. It's one of those projects that is ongoing but ends up being lower priority when you're talking about budgets and economic development and that type of thing. So just briefly, the Port of Douglas County was voted into an existence by the residents of Douglas County in 1958 at the same time that the Port of Chelan County was created. The primary purpose of the port districts at that point in time, their formation, was to assist with the concept of upriver navigation for natural resource, to be able to utilize the river for its ability to transport natural resources to and from markets. So that was the primary impetus. In 1961, the Port of Douglas County bought the southerly portion of this property, the park, in large part to advance that particular notion. In 1972, that effort was seen, I think, as not viable any longer. And so the Port of Douglas County applied for, at the time it was the Interagency Committee for Outdoor Recreation, we applied for a grant to be able to build Arondo River Park. We built it as a day use facility. It included the boat ranch and the boat ramp and the mooring facilities, as well as the restroom facilities, a picnic shelter, and the swim beach, as well as some landscaping and parking. In 1979, we entered into an agreement with the Chelan County Public Utility District. At that point in time, the Chelan County PUD acquired the northerly portion of the park, built some additional landscaping, a gazebo, and in 1979, we signed this interlocal agreement that said that we would manage and operate the park according to the Exhibit R plan that the PUD had with FERC at that point in time for Rocky Reach. And so we've been doing that since then. The Port of Douglas operated the park from its inception till about 1987 as a day use facility. In 1987, we did a concession agreement with Mike Van Lith and his wife, and they ran the park until 1998. It's at that point in time that the camping was installed and a fuel facility was installed in the early 90s. From 1999 until 2010, Jeff and Char Smith, not this Jeff Smith, ran the park as a concession arrangement with the Port of Douglas County. In those time frames, we were doing some additional projects. We did some significant upgrades in 2000 and 2001 using, again, RCO grant monies. We upgraded a lot of facilities in the park to be ADA compliant, and we revitalized some of the in-water facilities. And we have, for the last 38 years, given it a good college try in terms of trying to operate this park. When I was hired in 2011, shortly after I agreed to take the job, I became aware that we were going to run the park for a year. And so in 2011, the Port of Douglas County attempted to run the park. It included our maintenance supervisor at the time, about 75% of his time, as well as two full-time but seasonal employees for about April through October. And it was mostly successful. It was not something that we were necessarily set up to do, so we again looked at a concession agreement. And so from 2012 to 2014, we had Recreation Resource Management. They were an out-of-state company that does this as a regular practice across the Mountain West. For 2015 through 2017, we've had another concession agreement with CAN Management. Running RV parks is not our forte. We are a staff of four people. At the Port of Douglas, our primary charge is economic development for the region. And so in spite of all of our attempts to try and run this park at a at least at some sort of a break-even point, it is not. The two concession agreements, particularly with Char and Jeff and with the Van Liths, were I think, probably moneymakers for them. They have not been moneymakers for the Port of Douglas. From 2001 through the first half of 2017, our loss is about $325,000 in the hole, which is basically a subsidy on the part of the taxpayers in Douglas County to support the park itself. So we've been trying to work with the PUD to look at a better way to run and manage this park, one that still provides the benefits to the PUD for your FERC license arrangement, one that still continues to provide good public access to one of our natural resources that makes this a great place to live and work and recreate, and also to try and find a way to essentially stop the bleed for the small organization that we are to date. And so our request at this point in time is for consideration on the part of the PUD to be able to take over management of this park. What we have agreed to, in concept anyway, is the concept of transferring our portion of the park in terms of land ownership to the PUD, to have the PUD take on the operation and maintenance function for the park. And then for us, though, to retain the obligation that comes along with the RCO money that we've taken in the past. What that actually looks like, we're not abundantly certain at this point in time. We need to talk with RCO. We've talked with RCO, but the particulars of some sort of an agreement are yet to come based on today, as well as some other activities, I'm assuming. And so that is where we are today, and I appreciate the opportunity to provide you with some background and some context, and I would be more than happy to answer any questions and hand it back over to your capable staff.
Any questions at this point before we move on?
Lisa, could you repeat the figures that you gave earlier from 2001 until some date, the loss to the...
So from 2001, and the reason I picked 2001 is because that's when our QuickBooks came into being, so it's easy to report. through June 30 of 2017, the negative, the overall negative to the Port of Douglas is $322,825.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And Lisa, for the benefit of the board, would you just walk through the RCO grant, how much money there is and what the obligation is there?
Sure. So the total obligation is in excess of about $340,000, $350,000. When you take RCO money, it's intended, their intent, obviously, in providing you the grant money is to ensure that you're continuing to provide public access for whatever it is that you have asked money for. And they require you, essentially, by taking that money, to agree to keep that those facilities that you're funding with that grant in place in perpetuity, is the language actually in the grant assurances. They have a whole chapter in their manual on what that actually means, but in large part it basically means we've had our attorney investigated and we're not able to just pay the money and have it go into and be able to sell it. We can't do that. We can't pay the grant money back and just have it go to some private development. We do have the ability to transfer it to another public entity that has the ability to operate parks. The obligation is only for the day use facilities. It does not include the camping or the fuel facility. The fuel facility was actually decommissioned last year. We went through a process of doing that according to Department of Ecology requirements, and so the fueling is no longer an option at the Aranda River Park. So that in perpetuity obligation exists. It is capable, you can replace the use elsewhere. So if you want to petition RCO for a change in use, you can do that, provided you can make the argument that you're replacing that use in particular somewhere else in the same general vicinity.
Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Other questions at this point? So there have been a number of alternatives for operating the park considered over the years, and right now there are four under consideration. One is the status quo, nothing would change. Number two, ownership is transferred to the PUD and camping is maintained. Number three, ownership is transferred to the PUD and the park would transition to day use only or return it back to its original day use only status. Basically, the goal here would be to minimize the overhead and we would use contracted maintenance. And number four, ownership is transferred to the PUD and the park would convert to day use only, supported by PUD staff. Michelle, talk about next steps.
Thanks, Jeff. So if we're looking at what's coming next, the PUD staff, we have a team pulled together, real estate services, parks, legal, and others, to really work with the port and look at what it's going to cost, what are the likely events that have to happen with the RCO grant funding obligation, what kinds of public input we're proposing also to spend the next couple of months having meetings in Arondo, having meetings here, sending out some surveys to find out what the public thinks we should do with this park. Talking with the port, that park was originally set up as a day use facility for the area of Arondo, so we're we're thinking that the input from the local community might look different than the input we're going to get from others that are using the park for camping and probably coming from a little further away. So we would like to make sure that we've done a good vetting of this locally to see what the local community would like us to do and consider their input to this. So we're proposing to do that over the next month and a half. We'll use that to, again, evaluate the alternatives along with the costs. And then what we would like to do is come back to you, likely end of November, early December, to kind of lay out what we've learned, likely give you the response to the different alternatives, and then also a recommended approach and get your approval on how to move forward at that point.
Question for Lisa, and I don't know if you can actually answer this or not, but it's a 5-acre park. There's currently appears to me to be 38 camping spots, 13 RV and 25 tent sites. Mm-hmm. Realistically, how much day use has been going on in the last several years?
So one of the things that happened when we took over the park in 2011 is that the day use went up. Previously, it's my understanding that the concession agreement had pretty much ended up being almost a private campground for a lot of people that were known to the concessionaires. So we took the park back, and we didn't take reservations online any longer for camping, so it was first come, first serve. And that really provided a lot of opportunity for increased utilization of the park for day use purposes because it wasn't full of camping and tents and utilizing all sorts of spaces in the campground that weren't even necessarily set up as campsites themselves. I can't tell you the exact number of day use versus camping. I do believe it has increased. There are a number of local groups that use the park for events. For example, the community church in Arundo uses the park for a sunrise service on Easter Sunday. The East Wenatchee Rotary Club hosts a Pike Minnow Derby on Father's Day, and they operate out of the Arundo River Park for their facilities. And oftentimes in the fall, after the camping season is over, we get a lot of requests for people who'd like to access the boat ramp in order to be able to facilitate hunting and fishing opportunities. So I don't have a good number for you. I apologize. I think I can get you a number in terms of camping based on reservations from the last few years. And we can give you a total number of users accessing the site. Like your other parks, we actually have a meter at the park that helps us understand what the park use is so that you can report that on your, I think it's Form 80, FERC Form 80. We do have some total numbers, and we can extrapolate that.
What you did, Dummy, to me had great value, the fact that you made that shift just a few years ago, and it was obvious that there's desire for day use.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's important information.
Yes.
Yeah, we kind of get the sense from talking to people out there, the weekend day use has been minimized by the huge influx of people during the heavy use period. I mean, they're camping everywhere, and boat trailers everywhere. So it's been a good discussion with them. They've lost their community opportunity for access to the river.
So I guess my question might be directed to Ryan Baker or Jeff, to you, in terms of if that gets converted back to a day use, which I think is smart. Adequate facilities at BB, Daroga, and Lincoln Rock for camping, and regulated facilities that are currently well managed. Is that a fair assumption?
Good morning, Brian Baker, Park Manager. I just want to make sure I'm understanding your question.
Yeah, thank you.
Would you mind repeating that?
Okay, so if we adopted Arundo Park, converted it to day, there are people who are accustomed to coming there to camp. Capacity at BB, Daroga, and Lincoln should be able to handle those campers should we vacate the camping sites there and create a day use only.
Gotcha. I understand your question now. Thank you. What I would say to that, Dennis, is there are certain times of the year, particularly July and August, where we are full in all of those facilities.
Okay.
So I think that would be something that we would need to look at and part of our research as we
look okay. at this. Yeah, okay, that'll be interesting to get the data and take a look at that. But yeah, thanks.
Randy, this is Ann.
Yes.
Here, hold on just a minute. There. I just have a question for Lisa.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually looking at the PowerPoint, and I think you mentioned that your proposal would be that Port of Douglas County would retain the RCO grant obligations. And I didn't catch that. What would those obligations be?
Essentially, the obligation is to ensure that the facilities that were built with RCO money remain in perpetuity. So that's the way the grant obligation reads. I think the details of how that looks in an actual agreement between the Port District and the PUD, I can't answer that. I'm pretty sure that that will involve some attorneys. And it will also involve some buy-off from RCO. In describing the transfer of the ownership from RCO, it takes basically a letter from the two entities, signed by the two entities, indicating what the methodology is in terms of transferring ownership and or the obligation itself. So I don't think from a basic technical standpoint, it's not difficult to probably accomplish that, but the devil's in the details, I'm sure, in terms of how we manage to give property to the PUD but still maintain the obligation. So more to come on that one, I think.
So, Commissioner Jeff, we have had informal conversations with RCO, and they're receptive to our proposal. And again, the three elements of what we've discussed are: the PUD would acquire full ownership of the park at no additional cost, Douglas Port would retain the RCO grant responsibilities, and the PUD would agree to operate it as a park for the duration of the Rocky Reach license, which expires in 2052. So at a high level and a preliminary discussions, those are the elements of what we've discussed.
Okay, that's helpful. So there would be no financial obligations for Port of Douglas County if you were to transfer it to Chelan PUD?
In terms of ongoing basis, my assumption is no. That's one of the primary reasons for doing this, is because we do not have the capacity to do this thing, nor do it well. We've gotten by for 38 years. We've managed for 38 years, but we really are not set up to be an entity that is doing this activity.
So
there's no stipulation that grant money needs to be paid back or matched or anything like that.
No, the grant was matched at the point in time that we obtained it. So it wasn't a full grant for those facilities. So there was an investment on the part of the Port of Douglas initially in those projects to begin with. But it's my understanding from our legal counsel's evaluation and discussion back in 2015, we can't pay the money back and get out of the obligation. The obligation is in perpetuity.
Okay, great. Thank you, Lisa.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Question for you, Lisa. Does two questions, actually. One is directed to Lisa and the other to Jeff. The Port of Douglas does not own other recreational property where the RCO could be transferred to. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. And Jeff, you mentioned that we would accept liability up until the time of our relicensing. So if we fast forward, what happens, worst case scenario, trying to look around corners, if that relicensing isn't granted, what happens to that liability? Where's that liability go?
Good question.
I think that's what we're
trying to. Eric? Yeah, Commissioner, I think that's one of the details we're going to have to think through as we begin working on an agreement, assuming the concepts and the alternatives, any or all of them, are acceptable to the board. That detailed thinking, I don't know, has been accomplished yet.
Okay, thank you.
So back to the RCO money. Let's say it's what, 340, 350. Is that sitting there and has to be used for something that was originally funded under those grants, so repair or construction or reconstruction? Or can you give me an example of how that money is utilized?
That was a one-time, there were two different grants that that were given, and they were capital grants. So the facilities have been built. In the case of the second grant, it actually was an upgrade to the original project because we did some substantial upgrades to all of the existing facilities when we did our upgrade in 2001. So the total, that $300,000+, has already been spent on facilities at the park.
Okay. So I'm still confused as to what the obligation is then by...
We just have to make sure that we continue to, that those facilities that were built, so the boat ramp, the mooring facilities, the restroom building, the picnic shelter, that those things remain available as they were initially intended. There is some ability within the context of the RCO obligation, I believe, to make some changes as long as the intent and purpose, which is to provide public access to the river, is maintained.
But Douglas County Port has no ability under that grant to contribute to refurbishment or replacement?
No. We have recently, in some of the more recent years, attempted to get additional grant monies. So there are, we have a capital plan that we identified that actually the PUD helped us pay for back in 2014, I believe it was. With the intent that we would potentially qualify for additional RCO grants to either upgrade the facilities or to add new and different grants that allow for some type of operations and maintenance. But there really is no O&M type of a grant available in terms of RV parks or public facilities.
All right. Thank you. That helps.
Additional questions?
Just a comment.
Okay.
Just as somebody that used to use the park prior to the camping start, and then after that began, we stopped using the park. I really appreciate the fact that the PUD and the port are going to go into the community, engage the community in a dialogue, and provide that feedback back to us to aid in the assistance of a decision. So I appreciate
absolutely.
As a follow-up on that comment, I would really encourage you in your outreach process to attempt to identify the employee base that resides in that area, and it might, one of the viable avenues very well may be the employee break rooms in the fruit warehouses. There's a network there that may not be reached through traditional means.
Thank you. Good idea. Yeah.
Any other questions?
So with the nods, we will proceed on ahead.
You bet.
Okay. You bet. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lisa. Appreciate it. Michelle, Jeff, thanks.
Do we have time?
We do. Yes. I think we're right where we were hoping to be. Actually, worked out great.
Brian, thank you.
Thank you.
Next up, we want to talk about long-range facilities plan. Dan Frazier will be presenting.
Do we start this with a drum roll?
I'm a drummer. I can do that.
So we will pull up our presentation here. Dan Frazier, Director of Shared Services, with me.
Randy Cook, TCF Architecture.
So we are back for an update. We were last here in July, and at that time we were into implementation planning, and we were discovering some new things and verifying other assumptions as we moved through the initial study of this project. And we said we'd be back when we had some more understanding about our numbers and our options, about how we would phase things, and most importantly, impact on our financials. And so we're back to give that update to the board today. from the agenda and purpose, this is more the purpose in this slide. What we're here today is to seek concurrence with several recommendations. Those recommendations include proceeding with the Rock Island and Rocky Reach improvements identified in the facilities plan, to seek concurrence with the recommendation that we acquire property for a headquarters or operations and service center campus, and to seek concurrence with the recommendation that we continue outreach and increase our outreach surrounding that headquarters piece and the operations and service center piece. The agenda today is we'll be starting off with talking about the goals and the findings. Some of these slides you'll remember from past presentations, and they really have continued to be our guiding principles for as we've moved through this. What are our goals and what are we trying to achieve? So we'll look at the goals and findings, and then Randy will take us through the scope and the phasing and the costs that we've developed through a higher level of refinement than what you saw previously. Craig Koons will talk about the impact on our 10-year financial forecast as we move these numbers right into a snapshot of the forecast. And then we'll finish off with recommendations and next steps. So.
Excellent. Well, nice to see you all again. Last time I presented was in March, and I think we had a fairly lengthy set of slides that day. We've done our best to condense the presentation down in the interest of time. You will see in the first two slides, these are identical to the ones we showed you back in March. And actually, there's a little bit of they really go together. I'll start with the goals, and then in the next slide, we'll talk about what have we learned. And there's sort of a coalescing of all of this. As you go through discovery, you continue to refine what does it mean to have goals that have very key metrics that we can apply to everything that we're trying to do. So number one, productivity. Any new investments that are made in facilities, we want to make sure that we're leveraging the highest productivity that we can. Facilities should enhance our work. It should make our workflow better. They shouldn't impede us. So every decision that we go forward with, whether in planning or eventually in design, we want to make sure we're leveraging the highest levels of productivity. Number two, on service levels, we can think of that in two ways. One is just deploying your resources to the field in order to serve your customers with power and fiber and everything that you do. But also that interface, the interaction between your customers and your front door, your staff. We want to make sure that every decision that's made in facilities enhances and optimizes our levels of service delivery. Three and four kind of go together. Financial value, we want to make sure that every decision made today to invest, and there's some big numbers, as you know, leverage the greatest potential to have the least long-term spending. So we are projecting these numbers as far out as we can. We're building models that really try to take into account everything that we believe that you would do and what could you do. And so we want to make sure that we create the lowest possible spending for the district over long periods of time. And that really comes part and parcel with cost predictability. Right now, it's very difficult for your facilities staff to always have predictability and to forecast what your costs are going to be for maintaining facilities or producing new facilities of any kind. So we want to create stability, and we want to create that ability that once your facilities are in place, you have greater and greater predictability in forecasting what your costs are really going to be. It makes your job a lot easier and the budgeting process a lot easier. And finally, safety, and we could really add security to that, but every decision made in facilities, we should be enhancing safety on site for your workers, safety for your public. We shouldn't have trucks crossing in front of people that are on site. There's just so many things that come into play with safety and security. So what have we learned? You'll find some overlap here now. So over the process of discovery, it's become quite clear that the district has substantially underfunded its facilities. And this happens over a long period of time, and let me tell you, you're not alone. In the public realm, this happens a lot. We do a lot of work for public works and utility districts all around the state, and it's a common story. Decades go by, and you go, wow, what happened? The district has not previously really worked under any kind of cohesive master plan for facilities, and again, you're not alone there. Facilities have a way of popping up, and there's a need. Well, let's go build it. And before you know it, you've kind of hit a point where you're maxed out on a site, you're maxed out in your buildings. Nobody intended it to get to that point, but that's really where it's arrived. Also, what comes with that typically then would be really what we might call no standards at all. We think we operate by a set of standards. If you're going to do a remodel or a building, you certainly try to follow, you must follow every code in order to get a permit and get your occupancy. But in terms of an overall cohesive set of standards that any operation or any organization would apply, the district has not had that to this point. And so that became quite important as we think forward as to how would we plan for new facilities. And again, that the unpredictable nature of costs, it's become quite clear working with your facilities department that it's a very difficult thing. It's a challenge for the facilities department to continue to look ahead and forecast. And we know after going through all the facilities, and I know you have all toured the facilities, it doesn't take long to walk around and say, wow, we're asking our workforce to work within some challenging facilities, to be honest. And sometimes it's a lack of facilities. It's the fact that you're working outside in the snow or the heat, you know, and you don't have a proper facility. So all of that comes into play. And finally, we definitely know that it will take a large initial capital investment in order to leverage the kinds of goals and the kinds of benefits that we want to see long term. So you'll see those five goals show up as we go through the presentation. Very quickly, I'm going to take you through each of the sites. We'll, as Dan mentioned, we'll show you what the scope is that is in our current concept planning and really what's being recommended as the way forward as a strategic plan for each of the sites. Here you see an illustration of the headquarters. This would be a fully combined operation up in the old station property area. It combines several parcels into about 23 acres. This is everything that you have on this campus now and everything at Holly Street, as well as your other pool yard, all pulled together in a single facility. That's what the footprints represent, and allowing some room even in this diagram for some future expansion. All parking, one-stop shopping for customers at this point, and the deployment of all of your resources from a single location. It's a great opportunity. Parcel up there, and through all of the analyses we did, we looked at least seven different scenarios in terms of how you would rebuild on this campus, how you would rebuild at Holly Street, variations on those, split facilities, and then eventually a combined facility. And the combined facility is the only concept, it's the only alternative that satisfies all five of those goals or even exceeds them.
Quick question before you flip
yeah.
that. What, the upper left-hand corner, is that the CTC building?
You just see the CTC building peeking down there with the angle, yes. Briefly, as far as implementation, just to kind of give you an overall time frame, we're looking at about 4 years if you were to move forward in short order, with the very first priority being to acquire the land. We would move forward into preliminary design. Right now, we remain in a concept level. But even at concept level, we've filled in a lot of blanks. We do a lot of work. We're very methodical at going through and making sure that we've accounted for everything, but we haven't been able to go forward into actual, you know, preliminary design other than the footprinting you see. That would happen. There's a lot of permitting. There's a lot of upfront tasks that would have to happen. There would likely be an early site development package, and that would be followed by the construction of all the buildings and occupancy sometime out in late 2021. On the cost analysis side, this first little chart will give you just the big numbers. Last year, we were looking at roughly $114 million net. This is after all is said and done in terms of first capital, acquisition, and sales of property. This is really the net effect. After the last 6 months of going through and doing some additional analysis and revisiting the scope and just looking at the site further, we still maintain something pretty much in that range. We thought it best at this point to really express it as a range. There's still work to be done. There's still a lot of work in pre-design where we can continue to be just drill in and dial in more on the value of everything, every decision that's made. But keep in mind that these numbers are all-inclusive. It's construction, it's sales tax, it's permit fees, it's escalation. And on that note, just to keep this in mind, escalation continues to climb at a pretty healthy pace, and so we are budgeting in for where we believe the dollars will be once we hit those construction years out several years from now. that's the nature of work in the Northwest right now. It's just a continued robust economy, and so we have to plan even more carefully now than ever before. But of course, the first cost is just the first, that's important to understand, because without that, we don't know how to go forward and do the analysis. What we really want to know is, what's this going to cost over time? So in our 50-year model projections, you'll see out of all of those scenarios that we evaluated, it really came down to the three. Status quo being, what do we really believe that you will do without a plan? And it's not do nothing. It's, we're going to continue to do the things that we'll be forced to do. And it means you're forced to rebuild on this campus, rebuild at Holly Street, and continue on that path. Versus the second column over is a split facility where you would move an operations center up north to that same site and maintain some type of administrative center here, at least for some period of time. So in our analysis, we planned that to be essentially a phase to an ultimate combined facility, and you would see that that would be occupied, say, out in 2026. So we simply found a scenario that allowed us to stretch this thing out and to see how that would work. And finally, looking at a combined operation where it's all in and take care of it all at once in that four-year period. Now, if you imagine all of these dollars at the top going in at first to leverage this campaign, all of the costs over the next 50 years in terms of maintenance and operations, all of those costs, all of the savings or lack thereof for productivity, for travel savings, 50 years worth of that, now bring it all back to today in terms of today's dollars, and we would compare them head to head very consistently, and you can see where that net present cost would be in terms of today's dollars. And that's where the combined facility clearly makes up. We'll show you a graph in a little bit that shows what that really looks like. But being compared head to head, that's the way that the three scenarios perform. Again, in the interest of time, I'm going to keep on it here, and we'll move right through Rock Island and Rocky Reach. You're going to see a series of slides very similar. We'll show you the scope, the implementation phasing, and the financial analysis. So Rock Island, you can think of Rock Island really in terms of three zones. There's the Douglas side. There's the what we call Lower Chelan, which is really the deck level of the plan. And then there's the Upper Chelan area. In this scope, we have a certain amount of work happening over at the Douglas side. It's primarily remodeling buildings. It's not adding any new buildings. At the Lower Chelan side, we know that we have a lot of congestion down at the deck level, and the most important thing we need to solve at Rock Island is the cross-deck traffic. So the decision-making here is about getting the things that need to be on the Chelan side on the Chelan side, and that's primarily warehousing, tools, including engineering staff as well. And I know on your tour you were able to see firsthand what's happening out there. It's an extreme challenge. And if we can solve that, and we know we can solve that with the introduction of warehousing, tools, engineering staff, and that's those buildings you see, K and M, over on the lower side. There'd be some remodeling of buildings and even the removal of a couple of smaller buildings to create some better turnaround space. We don't have a lot of real estate to work with there, and we're going to have to do everything possible with it to make it function well. And then up on the Upper Chelan side, we have a couple, several new buildings as well as remodels. There'll be building C as a storage building, looking ahead now to storing parts for the rehab projects. Building B is a blast and paint building, which the district currently doesn't have. Those operations typically happen outside right now or get sent off site somewhere. And building L being a new crew building. And a variety of remodels. So again, Rock Island is a mix of new construction and remodels, as well as a fair amount of site work. If we look at the implementation, looking to have this project dovetail and be coordinated with the rehab work, this project is shown happening now much the same as headquarters getting after it here, even in the fourth quarter of 2017 with early design and permitting. Really site work, there's a tremendous amount of site work that has to happen out there. And there's several buildings that would be best to put on the early track. For instance, the blast building and the storage building. And of course, the storage building already has a fair amount of work already done in planning for it. Followed by the rest of the building construction and final site work. So we're really looking at approximately 3-year implementation plan here, which is what our analysis was based on. So in that analysis last year, in the scope that was put together, we were looking at about $36.2 million in terms of total capital cost. And revisiting that again over these last 6 months and working with the staff and crews to refine and revisit the assumptions, you can see it has grown just a little bit. This is mostly in terms of just some other assumptions on the types of buildings and what goes where, but there's some additional capital in that. And again, as with the headquarters, these are all inclusive budget numbers, all capital, all the permitting fees, sales tax, escalation, and so forth, really trying to make sure we've accounted for everything. And likewise, what happens when we look out at the total cost over time? What we're calling status quo at Rock Island would be what we believe you would do, and that's essentially what the scope last year when we worked with the staff and crews to say what's the least amount we can do out there to make this all work and the assumptions that were put on that. But then stretching that out over as much as 10 years. We're calling that status quo. It's a little bit more like maybe how the district has worked in the past, where things kind of happen incrementally over long periods of time. And we'll contrast that with the recommended master plan or strategic plan at this point, which has a little more capital in it, a few different assumptions on some of the buildings and the site work, and also taking into account escalation and all, and packaging it into a three-year implementation. And that's what we're calling the recommended strategic plan to compare to that status quo. And you can see, again, in terms of net present cost, a lower net present cost today in terms of all the dollars that are in the model brought forward to today's dollars. Okay. And finally, Rocky Reach. Rocky Reach doesn't suffer from quite the same challenge that Rock Island does in terms of the cross-deck traffic. However, there is some challenge at the center of the site where the fuel island and the hazmat building creates some congestion. So here, again, we have a mix of remodel and new construction happening. You have a new fuel island and hazmat building being moved further to the south. Similar to Rock Island, there's a storage building and a blast building, a little bit smaller, slightly different program needs because much of the work already happens inside the plant. And over in the center of the site, the blue building D is a new one-story office building for all of admin. Right now, you've seen some of the old modulars that have been added a long time out there. This building consolidates those. Building F is a new crew building. And really the signature building on the campus is the nice old C-17 original with the Rocky Reach installation. It's the main shop building, but it also currently houses all the crews and other office space. This building would be repurposed into still remain as shops, better designed shops, but also pull all the warehousing that's scattered among other buildings into a single location. So now you have your tool room, your warehouse, and your shops where they belong in that same building. That's the overall program, and in this case, because the rehab work continues, they really need to maintain functionality at the C-17, so we're not going to get in there and get after this one right away, and in fact, it makes it a little better for the overall implementation in terms of workforce resources in order to implement all these projects to push this one out a bit further. So you see this one running out as far as 2023. That allows that rehab work to finish, and then the phasing for this should dovetail nicely with getting after each of the buildings. And there'll probably be some work, you know, that would happen early on, of course, that you see. There's site work that needs to happen. There are water systems issues out there. There's sewer issues. Those things can be taken care of sooner with most of the buildings happening a little later on. Last year, we showed you a $32.6 million number for the assumptions at the time. And you see this one's grown a bit as well in terms of the last 6 months of just looking at all the possibilities and rethinking the way the site ought to work and landing at something in the $40 million range right now. That's grown quite a bit. However, the decision-making behind that and the recommendations behind that, a lot of it is focused on that C-17 building, but we also are fighting escalation to a degree, so there's more and more escalation as we push out, but that's and that's part of what's driving some of those numbers up. But again, as we compare the net present cost of what we would call the status quo being last year's assumptions, pushed out over a 10-year implementation plan, something just not quite as compact, versus today's assumptions where we were going to do more with building C-17 and create the crew building. So there's some other capital assumptions there. Compressing it a little bit better than 10 years back into 6 years, and we still see a better net present cost between the two. So we're still seeing a positive in that sense. There's still, as I mentioned before, a lot of work to do on all of these, and in order to get in from this conceptual level we're at and find every economy that we can. That's about as quickly as I could possibly go through all those for you, and I think I'll turn it over to Kirk for just a moment on the next set of numbers.
Kirk Hudson, Managing Director of Generation and Transmission. I just wanted to speak a little bit to the timing associated with the hydro facilities that Randy just went over, and to provide a little bit of context for the facilities that were put up there on the screen. As you know, the hydro facilities generate approximately 10 million megawatt hours of energy each year, generating hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue for the district. Very important assets to the district and what we provide. Just as we've spent the last year and a half, 2 years, going through the economics of our generating units and the turbines, the powertrains at the hydro facilities and how valuable those are, to get to the point where we've made some major decisions to invest approximately $250 million in those powertrain assets over the next 5 to 7 years. We're at a very similar point, decision point, with our facilities at the same time. Those facilities that were up on the screen, many of them were from original construction, 1950s. Rocky Reach, some of them 50s, and some of them earlier at Rock Island. They were intended to be, in some cases, temporary for the construction. They've been repurposed and adapted by our workforce on how we can provide ongoing O&M services. So many of those facilities don't even fit some of the equipment that we actually have to maintain day in and day out. So at that decision point that we're at right now on our facilities, we know our hydro facilities are going to be around for a number of years. They're going to be around for the foreseeable future and longer than I can predict in terms of my lifetime here. So our support facilities are likely going to be around for that same amount of time. So we're at this critical point where we have an opportunity to provide facilities for the ongoing sustainable future of the hydro facilities. So I wanted to just talk about the timing, why this is an important time for us. Rock Island, that's in a category by itself with the amount of work that we're doing down there, going through all of Powerhouse 1, and then we plan to begin Powerhouse 2 in the next 5 years. So the timing for those facilities with the amount of equipment and people that are mobilizing, that are currently mobilized and will be mobilizing, we're actually behind the eight ball on that one. We could have used facilities yesterday. But we have the opportunity right now to prepare for what's coming up in the next 3 years with those facilities at Rock Island. Rocky Reach, we have a little bit of time there, and that's why you saw the phasing. We've moved some of the shop facilities out a couple of years just because of the major repair work on the large units at Rocky Reach. We still need those shop facilities for the next 3 years. As far as the storage facilities go and some of the other facilities that were showing up on the screen, now is a perfect time. Just as we're doing one unit a year on the repair side at Rocky Reach, we have the golden opportunity for those other support facilities to actually be taken care of as we speak, so that by the time we finish the repair of the large hydro units at Rocky Reach, we'll actually have the facilities in place to move all the spare parts and inventory and equipment out of the powerhouse that's currently providing congestion there into a facility that was actually designed for that intended purpose. So then when we get done with the large unit repairs, our powerhouse is all 11 units running. We got all the spare parts. We have all the equipment in a storage facility that's inventoried. And we have our facilities in place to go forward on an O&M side. I think the other opportunity that we have now with both of these, particularly timing associated with Rocky Reach, is we have an opportunity to bundle as many of these projects as we can into contracts so that we can see what we can do to drive the cost down. If you piecemeal these contracts individually, the costs go up substantially in terms of the administration side and what you can do from a competitive advantage with volume. So those are the reasons we think now is the opportune time to get into Rocky Island and Rocky Reach, and available to answer any questions you might have in terms of the hydro facilities.
Question? Yes, I've got one that I'm looking at the presentation and the while the projected cost on Rock Island, the whole package went up modestly, the Rocky Reach went up substantially. Can you maybe provide a little more insight as to why they went? I mean, we're in a tough bidding environment right now. I know that because everybody's building and there's all kinds of nightmare stories. But there's a substantial difference between those two.
Yeah, so I'll go ahead and address that. Rock Island's is a little more modest. The primary driver on that was looking at doing a new crew building as opposed to using the old crew building, seeing if there's some benefit to being able to have the rehab contractor potentially use some of the old buildings while the district can move into something that's going to last a bit longer than that. Some of the site work, just looking at what all needs to be done with the site work. Those are the things that really got Rock Island up a little bit more. Rocky Reach, similarly, the brown building F you see there is a crew building that, in the last round of assumptions, we were still just trying to keep everything within C-17 and not really mess with it. So everything was just getting remodeled over time. As we looked at the possibility of how that building could be used better by moving all the warehousing and redoing all the shops in that building number went up, but of course so did the fact of putting a crew building, building F out there and trying to do
building.
We added that building, right? And some site costs as well, and the rest of it's mostly an escalation. So it's kind of a mix of things. And what happens at this budgetary stage, you know, as soon as you add some capital, it gets all the other markups that go with that. And so it kind of has this expanding. That's why capital, so, you know, that first scope is so important to try to get right, because all of the other costs that come with it, soft costs and escalation, you know, all tend to, dogpile on to that first number. And again, there's work to be done. I would say right now, as I sit here, I'm anxious to get in with the, that real preliminary design where we can get after and get beyond more of the assumptions base, because we know the square footages are good, and we know the thinking is good. We know the approximate locations of buildings is good, but that's all they are right now. They're footprints, and they really need to go to that next level. And as Kirk even said, being able to bundle projects, there's a number of strategies to work and try to drive costs, back down again, but that's, those are the reasons why those numbers have bumped up.
And I can.
Originally, there was a very, very aggressive schedule as part of the purchase up here. We sent them back to talk about what could actually get done and how does it fit with the other work that we're trying to get done out there. So now you've got an elongated schedule, and you had an inflationary factor that is higher than the general rate of inflation because of the bidding environment.
Yeah,
the bidding environment.
It's tough.
Yep. I'd like to add, too, the benefits of this additional facility that Randy just spoke about. You remember the warehouse, walking through the warehouse on the tour at Rocky Reach. You remember that wasn't really intended to be a warehouse in terms of the low ceilings and the racks that are in there and the space and the aisle narrow width. What this does is allows us to get the warehouse in with the shop so that the employees have the warehouse, the tools, and the shop all in one building. The crews, for the most part, this building, they show up in the morning, they use the crew facility, and they're off to work, and they show up later on in the day, and they're back changing in the crew facility. They don't need that space in the shop facility. It could be better used for that tools and equipment warehousing right there with the shop space. And then the additional benefit, too, is the dive area. It allows us to provide a better facility for the dive crew at the same time, repurposing some of that building there.
I figured you just put that on there because you didn't want us to forget what we saw.
It's true.
I'll let these guys go through the rest of the numbers.
Is Craig going to?
Good morning again, Craig Coons. Okay, so you've seen a lot of numbers, and I'm going to try to put it into context of what it means in regards to our current long-term forecast. The most important takeaway that Randy discussed is that whether or not we adopt a strategic facilities plan under a combined or split scenario or continue with our reactive status quo, there are some, we've learned that there are some significant increases that we need to put into our financial forecast. So what we start here is with our base August 31st, 2017 forecast. And how we show these numbers and make the adjustment is we take the scenarios that were prepared, look at what the incremental changes would be, because we do have costs, we do have assumptions related to facilities in our 831 forecasts. We just realized that we learned that we need to increase those cost assumptions. So what this slide represents is continuing with a reactive philosophy focused mainly on cash and debt impacts. And what we learned is, under making those incremental changes under a reactive philosophy, that the cash maintains relatively, it's relatively the same under either scenario, because we assume we're going to issue debt in the longer term view in the 2020-27 timeframe to maintain our liquidity. But adding the additional costs would give us an increase in our debt position in 2027 of $152 million compared to what we have in the forecast as of August 31st, 2027, or August 31st, 2017. So that's kind of the takeaway you can get from there on cash and debt. I would note that, you know, this is focused on cash and debt, but in this time period, other financial metrics become stressed in the 2022, particularly cover calculation, which means we have to do some plan refinements and some decision making, possible actions like debt refinancing, modifications to our accelerated debt, and cost containment are things we need to consider in this time period through 2027. There's a lot of tools in our toolbox. There's a lot of flexibility out there. But it's important to note, as I'll put everything in context, we go to the next couple slides. This is looking at a 2017 through 2027 time frame. You know, the numbers that Randy were talking about were over a 50-year period. So you're going to see relatively similar impacts to our financial position based on the financial forecast through 2027. Under any scenario, but a lot of the benefits that we get from a strategic long-term facilities plan incur over a longer period, which drives down that net present value cost, and a lot of additional costs would be forecasted outside this time frame under a status quo scenario. So there's a really nice slide coming up that will kind of put that into context.
This is combined here.
Okay, now looking at the combined facilities, I will highlight, oh, and I'm going to go back to the other slide. I just wanted to note, in regards to the flexibility, note that the debt ratio in 2027 under the reactive status quo was at 27%, still below our 35% target, which was obviously alluding to the flexibility we still have for issuing debt out in that time frame. So looking at the combined facilities plan, relatively similar to the status quo in regards to where we are financially in 2027. Cash balance remains the same. Again, we're all assumptions that we're borrowing to maintain liquidity out in those time frames. And we have a debt increase in 2027 of $158 million. So I think that's an incremental change of about $3 million. Looking at the split facilities, again, cash remains the same, and we would have an incremental debt of $164 million compared to our base forecast of $831. And again, debt ratio is in the 27-28% range, which we maintain our flexibility. Now, in the split scenario, you know, the timing of these, a lot of the debt, how the debt plays out is based on the timing of the expenditures. We're accelerating some debt on the combined. We're delaying a little bit of capital on the split. But this next slide kind of brings it all together. This is the cumulative 50-year cash flow look. And the gray line is the status quo reactive philosophy, and the yellow is the combined facility scenario. And if you see in the 2027 time frame, 2028, 2029, they're basically identical, which is kind of what those graphs, the previous slides were showing, is your debt is basically the same situation. But you can see the accelerated need for additional costs compared to what the combined facilities is beyond the 2030 time frame. It's pretty dramatic, and this is when that net present value calculation tells you that, you know, you got additional savings under the strategic facilities plan, and you got additional costs on the status quo beyond the time frame that we're looking at to the 2027. So I like this slide. I think it really brings everything into context and brings it all together. The difference between looking at a 50-year NPV calculation, the 2017 through 2027 financial forecast look, this kind of brings it all together and ties it all together. So I'd open it up for any questions right there.
Question? I just have more of a comment. Two things. This is, in my mind, really similar. You know, you talk about public facilities, but we can even relate this back to our own houses.
Sure.
You know, that it gets, you just go on or you do without and you try to save some money, and then all of a sudden you're just into some big money, and most people, to do big things on their house, have to go out and borrow that money. They haven't planned on that, thought about that. What we're doing is we're trying to eliminate that and get out ahead of this as quickly as possible. in the public facility arena, I think it's commendable that for year after year after year, you're trying to do with as little expenditure as you can, and then you find yourself saying, these facilities just don't make sense anymore. They're just not working, and it's not, they weren't purposefully built for what we're using them now. And then when you add to the fact that to keep doing what you're doing is going to cost you as much as doing something new and replacement, then in my mind, at least, it helps us as commissioners to make good decisions. Lastly, I got to experience something that I've heard you guys talk about before. I was going out past Lowe's and heading toward Save Mart and decided, oh yeah, the railroad tracks. Do I risk it or not? And it was in the morning, and I got out there, and all of a sudden I realized I shouldn't have risked it, because everything was packed up there in front of the PUD building. The trucks weren't going anywhere, and honest to goodness, it must have been 15 or 20 minutes that everybody sat there. And I'm just looking around, shocked as to, you know, I mean, I'm irritated with the loss of my own time, but then I'm really looking as a commissioner and saying, oh my gosh, we are just, this is just kicking us down the road here. This is not a good situation. So that was a priceless learning opportunity for this commissioner to just sit there and watch that.
Questions, comments at this point? I'm just a thought. I'm looking at this. I love the longer term look, because growing up in the fruit business with warehouses that build for 30, 40, 50, sometimes 70 years, understanding the value of those facilities over the long haul is really, really important to look at, not just the initial cost. So, thank you for this chart right here. Mm-hmm. Real value.
Yeah, I, Craig, thanks for the graph. That's very, very clear.
You're welcome.
Nice piece of work.
All right. So you've got more treats for us.
Yep, more to come. Oh, we've got more presentations.
That's what I said, more treats. More
couple of concluding slides here. I'll probably... So if you just look at the combined, everything all in, all three sites, headquarters and both hydros, looking at a range, and we're expressing it in a range because, again, like I said, there's work to be done, there's value to still be captured, there's things that we can do to continue to find the most economical way to implement these facilities. So we're looking at that 188 to 195 range, again, all in. And then if we look at the combined 50-year overlay on net present cost, or just present cost, status quo 197 versus what we'll see in the recommended strategic plan. So we choose the combined facility approach on the headquarters, we choose the 3-year implementation on Rock Island, and the other one we showed you for Rocky Reach, and we're looking at that present cost range of between 183 and 185, just based on that range above. So the savings is really 12 to 14 million in terms of present cost dollars when we put all of it together.
The numbers at the bottom just reiterate what Craig just shared with you. Okay. And again, just to remind you, everything we're doing, it's easy to get lost in the numbers. It's easy to get myopic in a hurry on any given item. And trust me, there are reams and reams, volumes of documentation to even get to these nicely boiled down, condensed numbers for you today. But at no time does the team lose sight of the five goals. Everything that we're doing is based on these goals. So with that, turn it over to Dan and Sam.
Sam Daly, project manager. I've been with this project since 2014 when we completed the strategic plan. We were asked to do a strategic facility plan. Coming back, been working on this pretty much full-time throughout that period, as well with a couple other projects. But our first recommendation from this plan is to go forward with the hydro sites, go forward with Rocky Reach and Rock Island. Specifically, that means begin pre-design work on Rocky Reach and Rock Island. Rock Island, we would be bringing forward resolutions for consideration of engineering and design work, starting, as you saw in the schedule, Q4 2017. Talked a little bit about the project delivery method. Kirk mentioned there's some opportunity to combine the projects, get a little bit better efficiency, better productivity out of our resources. So we intend to, with this recommendation, we intend to move forward with evaluating procurement methods. Specifically, what the recommendation means is including these costs in the Q4 financial forecasts. We would include those in the 2018 budget, and we'd include those projects that are identified on the presentation moving forward in 2018. Alternatively, as we mentioned, the status quo, you've seen those slides. The status quo is the path that we're currently on. So, alternative to moving forward with the recommendation, we would move forward with the status quo process.
I want to draw a distinction between this recommendation and the one you're going to see in a moment for the other buildings. If you go back to both the customer owner comment that we've received so far, as well as what we heard in the survey when we did strategic planning, there it was certainly less controversial to proceed with these projects than with the others. We just really have received almost no comment on this, other than if it's cost effective, then you should be proceeding with these. So our refined analysis continues to show that these projects are cost effective using the same analysis as we would use for hydroturbine investment. And for that reason, we're recommending to proceed with the work to be able to bring forward the RFP. So this is not a final decision, because the normal processes that we employ with respect to board decision making would still occur here. We'd be bringing back RFPs to go through the bidding process, and ultimately RFPs that are concluded for board approval. But at this point, we're recommending that we not take or open this up for further comment, but just begin to move forward. Again, that'll be separate from the decision that we're recommending with respect to the service center and the headquarters building.
So as Steve mentioned, for the headquarters, we have a little more lengthy process we'd like to recommend, and that includes going out for that public comment. Pending board agreement today, we're looking to reconstitute our work group. As you recall, we had a citizens advisory committee that helped us through the first phase of this, and part of their input included, if it makes sense to the hydros, why are you asking us? But they do want to continue to help us and be our sounding board through some of the options that are around the headquarters and service center option. So we would continue to work with that group and engage in a more lengthy outreach process. I've been working with communications to help develop that process. We would seek to conclude land acquisition that would come back for board approval. It's something that's definitely necessary for us to be able to move forward with any option in that area, would be to acquire the land. We would, after we have that continued outreach concluded, or at least concluded to our satisfaction that we have some good information, we would bring that back to the board for further consideration of our options. But until that time, we would request that the financial forecast going forward include that status quo as a placeholder so that we can more intelligently inform what our forecasts are. As from that early slide of what we've learned we're not funding facilities to the degree we need to be. So this would at least remedy that to the point of we will be including those costs that we assume we would incur going forward. And then, of course, we could revise those if we do choose a path of development of another site.
I'd like to add just one quick piece to what Dan said. So one of the things that we wrestled with was the question about whether to proceed with the negotiations on the land acquisition at the same time the public comment is happening on the option. I want to be clear that it is not a fait accompli that we would complete the land acquisition. What we do need to know is what the cost of the land acquisition would be in order to validate the assumptions that we've used in the economic analysis. So that, and we could not proceed with land acquisition without board approval. So we would plan to go through that process, come to a conclusion with respect to, so what is a reasonable negotiated agreement that we could achieve, and then bring that back in roughly the same time frame that we would be able to make the bigger decision about do we want to do the service center headquarters operation in terms of a significant move, and do we want to use a phasing approach to that. So hopefully we put all those pieces together for you.
With that, is there any questions?
Additional questions from the commission? Would like to offer the opportunity for anybody in the audience, if they have any questions or comments, feel free to come up and state your name and address for the record and any questions or comments. Answered all the questions.
So I think what we would be looking for is the general head nod as to strategy. Is this the right strategy for us to be on at this point in time? Are you comfortable with that?
I think it's a good, prudent plan.
It's a yes for me.
Yeah.
Good. Okay.
All right.
We'll proceed then.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This time, it probably is, you have a two-minute manager item?
I could do one two-minute manager item, yeah. We were approached by a gentleman who works at Pacific Northwest Labs a few weeks ago with respect to a presentation that he had made in Richland regarding the development of electric vehicles that's going on in the industry and in the community. Had offered to make a similar presentation here in Chelan County. He made that proposal to a couple of folks in the community at about the same time. We got together. We've said, yes, we'd be interested in doing that. So we will be co-sponsoring that event November 1st at the CTC. And certainly, you all would be invited. We'll have to think through the if you all chose to come, whether it's a public meeting or not. Should be an interesting presentation, I think. Certainly, there is a heck of a lot of discussion going on around electric vehicles. There's a lot going on in the industry. I think you'll find the presentation to be quite interesting. We are seeing a lot of activity in the state legislature with respect to support for electric vehicles as an option to address greenhouse gas emissions. So wanted you to be aware of that, and you'll be hearing more from us about it too. I think that's it for now.
Okay. That being the case, why don't we now recess and reconvene at 1 o'clock for our afternoon session. I'll call the afternoon session of the October 16th, 2017 Public Utility District Number 1 of Chelan County's meeting to order. We met this morning in a study session and had a lot of updates on a lot of very timely and interesting issues. We'll meet this afternoon now in our business session. Just a reminder for everybody, as we were talking about it up here, to check your cell phones, make sure that they're in the silent position, if you will, please. And once again, if anybody wishes to speak to any item on the agenda, come forward to the table and use the microphone and state your name and address for the record as these meetings are recorded. Commissioners. First item on the afternoon is the consent agenda. This morning we modified the consent agenda to include resolutions 11, 12, 13, and 15. Is there a motion for approval?
So moved. Second.
It's been moved and seconded to approve the consent agenda. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Opposed? Motion is carried. We are down to manager items.
Actually, we've got 14.
Actually, we have,
yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. You're right. We have one resolution 14.
A resolution authorizing the general manager to enter into a services agreement, SA number 17-157, with Alcatel-Lucent USA Incorporated of New Jersey for microwave support services. You may recall that we've had a presentation last meeting about where we're going with microwave and trunk radio. This is a follow-on to that presentation. And
by the way, guys, I want to apologize. I didn't want to cut you out of the opportunity of doing this, honestly.
They would have been highly disappointed.
They put those ties on and everything. Got to be worth some value.
Yes. Good afternoon. Mike Coleman, Managing Director of Fiber and Telecommunications, and obviously I didn't get the memo on the tie.
Either did I.
I did want to open this up and provide a little perspective prior to Dave and Bob going through the resolution and the background to it. When we look at this project, and particularly when I looked at the numbers that were associated with it, and they came back with their proposed plan and methodology for procuring not only the equipment, but maintenance, it caused me to say, wow, they were creative, but it was more than them. It was a team effort, not only the project team, but procurement and legal, particularly our general counsel. So what we ended up with was a package that not only provides us the hardware, but it provides us the manufacturer support for 10 years, the expected life cycle of the equipment. And in return for looking at it on a long-term basis, the company did give us a very healthy discount. So we not only had the creativeness to get a better deal for the district, we also leveraged a product that fits right into the district, the knowledge, the skill sets, and it's going to allow Fiber to buy some additional management platform capabilities at a highly discounted price. Mm-hmm. So altogether, it's a win-win. I promised I wouldn't take all of David's thunder away in talking about this, but it is an opportunity for the district to benefit not only immediately from the procurement, but also long-term from the procurement. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Good afternoon, Commissioners. David Lodge, Project Manager with Engineering and Project Management.
And I'm Bob Shane with the Director of the Fiber and Telecom Department.
And we really enjoyed presenting to you at the last meeting on the microwave and radio project. So we asked if we could come back again this week and do another presentation.
Oh, we're excited. Yeah.
Good. We are too. So at the last meeting, we told you that we were well on our way working on a contract with Nokia, Alcatel-Lucent, for the microwave project. And I wanted to back up and tell you a little bit about how we got to this point. So we're using the NASPO, the National Association of State Purchasing Officers contract. It's a state contract that's available to public agencies, including the district. And that contract allows us to go pick a manufacturer and purchase what they have on there at the discounted prices that are listed, because the public procurement process has already been performed. Our project team wanted to go one step further, and so we did a pretty extensive evaluation of the different manufacturers available on the NASPO contract, and asked for information on all the different systems that are available and asked for pricing for 10 years of support. And we did an evaluation of three of the leading manufacturers and selected Alcatel-Lucent, Nokia. Alcatel-Lucent is a Nokia company, so I'll use the two names somewhat interchangeably. They were selected based on their superior technical capabilities. Without getting too into the weeds on this, they have a very advanced services, which include end-to-end integration features. It's an integrated solution, not a bunch of pieces that are assembled together to make a system. And it allows us to replace some of our other ancillary bolt-on equipment because it's one solution for the whole network. Has enhanced cybersecurity capabilities, including end-to-end encryption. Instead of encrypting one hop at a time, it encrypts the whole stream, which allows us to send more secure data across the network and meet our compliance requirements. And then also there's software and management systems that are compatible with the existing infrastructure we have for the fiber to the home network. Mike even mentioned that the management platform will be able to be used by this system as well as our fiber system. So there's some opportunities there. So in total, the project cost based on the NASPO pricing, which is already a competitive pricing for the project as well as 10-year support services, was $3.6 million. But because we were looking at a 10-year support term, Nokia gave us a 30% discount or $1 million discount, just about $1.1 million, for a net total of $2.5 million for the purchase. So like I said, we'll be purchasing the project, the equipment and the installation using the NASPO contract, and we're able to authorize that under delegated authority. But for the support, because the term of the NASPO contract doesn't extend for the life of that 10-year support contract, we're proposing to do that on a separate service agreement, which requires board authorization and the reason we're here today. So we're presenting a resolution authorizing service agreement 17-157 with Alcatel-Lucent for the microwave support services. The estimate from Alcatel-Lucent was just over $1 million for the 10-year term. Then we're requesting a not-to-exceed amount of $1.2 million because as the network changes over time when equipment is upgraded or new components added, we'll want to have the ability to expand that coverage up to $1.2 million. And Bob is going to explain a little bit about what the support services entail.
Thank you, David. So you probably imagine staff has determined that the support is necessary to operate and maintain this microwave system for its full life. It directly helps support and protect our long-term investment in such a solution. It's going to be around for at least 10 years, and this type of service would really help us maintain that asset to its full benefit. There's basically three different maintenance contracts that we are purchasing under this. One is a software support. So as the system moves along and there's integration or changes in the software support program allows those software improvements to be added to the system at no charge as part of the service. It does the typical patches and fixes that you have associated with any type of a platform that has a software platform that sits beneath it, and this system is very much a very active computer type based system with lots of software. So it guarantees that longevity and making sure the software patches go forward. It does not include major enhancements of the software package. So if there's advanced feature sets that come along, that's not part of this. It's more the maintenance side of it. The other part is maintenance support. So as you can imagine, this system has a lot of different components to it. We have a maintenance support program that allows for repair and replace of most of the components of the system. That's done through a escalated process. So certain products have a quicker response time in getting returned and replaced as part of the program. It also, as we have things just normally fail, instead of having to have that equipment on hand as part of our stock of inventory, we simply send that equipment in for repair and replacement. It's much more cost effective in doing that. Third one is technical support. It's a very complicated system with a lot of configurability. And so with that, you need a pretty robust technical team to help us manage that system throughout the life of the system. Software changes create technical changes, which require technical expertise to help reprovision the system to make it work and meet expectations. We also will monitor the performance of the system as we see issues come up. Tech support, technical support would help us address those issues and understanding if it's a configuration issue, if it's a device is beginning to fail, and we tie that back into our maintenance program and get advanced replacement on parts that are failing, and we can keep up with the services as we go forward. So that's basically the three major services that we have under support contract. It's pretty typical for a system this big and this complicated to have these types of services. Any questions on that?
I don't believe so. You did very well in your process. And part one of your presentation that didn't relate to the resolution was impressive, the 30% discount that you managed to garner. I'd be impressed if I was Mike, too.
He's moved over here.
He's moved. Yeah. Nicely done.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Appreciate it very much.
Commissioners, we have Resolution 14. Is there a motion for approval?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we approve Resolution 14 as stated.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to approve Resolution 14 as stated. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is carried. Now, manager items.
Got a few. Want to start. We're going to welcome Tim Pettit to the table. We don't get to see him very often, so pleasure to see him here. I want to talk about Slide Bridge. You may recall this is the project where we had the fire damage. And Tim's going to let us know whether we're close to finish or finished. And John Goodwill.
Yeah, so I'm going to start because I took the project from the cradle to the grave. He helped make sure the grave got taken. So, you guys probably, good afternoon, John Goodwill, project manager.
Tim Pettit, operations manager for the distribution department. Good
afternoon. I'm not sure if you guys recall back in 2015, the First Creek Fire. What happened was the Forest Service did some backburning and destroyed our system. So the fire itself didn't actually get us, but we worked with FEMA right off the bat to establish all the recovery scope of work, and this is the last piece of all the work we did to recover from the fire. The reason it took so long is we went down a little bit of a journey, and we started out by looking into a solar option. And the whole purpose of this line that was installed by citizens back in 50s or 60s, they hauled all the equipment up there and installed it, was for this communications area. So you have Chelan County-owned Chelan TV up there. Emergency broadcast system, I think, plays a role in there. Forest services up there, so forth. So the fact that the fire burned down the system was important that we restored it. So in 2015, we established a scope with FEMA, and then late that year, we worked with the general manager and others to look at a solar option. And we included all our stakeholders, and what the bottom line on that solar option was, it was kind of a beast, and it was going to be big with about 250 batteries. Well, if we were to wait 5 years, the batteries would probably drop to maybe 50 because of the technology, but it's not quite available yet. So the timing wasn't really good. And then also we would have had all our various components, like maybe the different departments involved. You would have mechanics involved. You would have the distribution department. So you started to bring a lot of different departments involved, which increases overhead costs in the long term. So ultimately, everybody agreed that we should go to the overhead rebuild, but that we should do it with steel poles so they don't burn down. So a picture here was 2016, I think March or April, we got up there and started working on this project for the overhead power rebuild, and some pretty good pictures to show. But this is what we actually did. We did, it's very steep terrain. We restored power with the overhead system pretty much in the same alignment. Poles weren't exactly always the same, but we got a Forest Service permit. It took a year to do that, which is actually a major accomplishment. Many folks aren't lucky. Kudos to Chelan office. Leavenworth office is a problem. Here's the helicopter work. It was a lot of work. They also used a spider, which is an articulating type of piece of equipment, to dig as many holes as they could get access to. But they did the majority of the holes good old-fashioned hand digging in rock. Mm-hmm. Nasty work. You can see here, this is the new poles installed. And you see the linemen working on it. And then here's the final line. and the helicopter just inspecting, or it's the final stage. This project went really well, really, really well. We finished in 3 weeks, so on schedule, and it was on budget. So the bid was really good.
So 3 weeks to do the project. How many weeks for the permits?
Over a year for the permits.
That's actually fairly quick.
Yeah, it is quick. Chelan office is great.
Yeah.
Paul Willard is amazing.
He means not the Chelan office of Chelan PUD. So it's
the Forest Service.
We're having some struggles getting permitting for a Forest Service project up in the Lebanon.
And then you can just click it.
Yep.
Afternoon, commissioners. I guess this would be the culmination of the project. This is actually outside of the FEMA reimbursement part of the project, is why the Chelan County PUD crews did this. And this pole was identified during the project at being well beyond life. We found some real issues with it. So I'll just run through this real quick. We just did this about a week and a half ago. And you'll notice on your left, the pole up here on the solid rock face is the pole that's in question, and it's actually broken one location. So we partnered with our CM generation crew with their 240-ton crane because there is no access to that pole anymore. Over the last 50 years with the building and construction of homes and things, there's no access anymore. So the only way to work on that pole was using, fortunately, the equipment that we have here at the district. This is a highline truck. It would not reach the pole, so that was used just to transfer material up and down from that structure. This structure is actually the takeoff pole for Slide Ridge, so this is where the line begins to head up to the project area that John was talking about. This, of course, is the new pole in transition to that location. Yeah, there we go. We needed to lower the pole actually down between the phases. And so to do this project, there was a couple other departments involved, which Tika is here with the outreach part of that. We also had to contact fire personnel, law, make sure that they had the opportunity to get vehicles on the uplake side of this because we had the road completely shut down. And I think congrats to Tika and others that I don't believe we received one phone call during this whole project of any customers that were upset. Lowering the pole down, this pole actually sits right on top of the rock. We put in what you would call a four-tiered anchor. The rods are drilled down into the rock, and then the pole is bolted into this cage, basically. This is our crew doing the transfers. Again, a lot of heavy lifting when we're up doing this, but I'd like you to pay attention to the old structure that is there with the double cross arms, and you'll also notice the angle that that pole is leaning. That's at its normal. And here you can see the bow and the pole, but again, notice the double cross arms in both locations. The reason I say that is there's what it looks like now. And those are fiberglass arms. That's something new that we've went to in the distribution department through quite a bit of investigative work and some other utilities using those. The reason that we've went to these in a number of locations is for avian protection. This pole is in a prime location that overlooks Lake Chelan. And with one single arm, you don't get osprey and other avians, eagles building nests on them. They can't. There's nowhere for them to start their nests. So it works fantastic there. So there is the new. There is the old. And I guess bottom line is the crews here at Chelan PUD, they're very talented in the work they do. And they do quite a variation of work. And like I said, when you look at the old pole to the new pole, that's pretty much when they do work, that's the difference you get to see. They do a great job. So, again, this was done a week and a half ago, complete road closure, about 240 customers involved, and when the project was complete, we hadn't received one complaint from anybody. So, any questions on that?
Great.
I'm just curious, Tim, that old pole that was there, was that
somehow drilled into the rock, or how was that anchored?
It was, but it was very shallow.
Oh, well, that explains leaning, right?
Yeah, so the other support for those is there's some down guys on those poles. Otherwise, yeah, the pole would have never stood. So
yeah,
it was very shallow in the rock, so we chose to go with a quad anchor system that the pole actually just sits right on top of the rock, and it's held in place by the cage that's around it.
So. Yeah, it looks really good.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. Wow. Impressive.
And we didn't have our crews doing helicopter work, which was good.
Although they may want to do it.
I don't know.
We do it on
that's scary. Hand. Those guys went to and from the helicopter, hanging.
Oh, wow.
They were transport. It's so steep they couldn't afford to lose their energy walking that all transportation was hanging from a cable. I didn't show those pictures. I had them, though.
I can verify that. That hill is probably
super steep.
50 degrees, 60 degrees,
oh,
possibly steeper.
Yeah, and the holes were dug. What we did differently, instead of drilling with the anchors above ground, we put caissons in the ground, so like culvert pipe. Mm-hmm. So they dug those in, and then the poles could just fly right in, and then we fill it with gravel. So,
wow.
It's a good project.
Wow. Wow. Thank you.
Very impressive.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Okay, I would like to do an update on the we have municipal bonds, derivatives class action settlement, and Heather Ireland's going to tell us about that.
And Heather, this is financially as excitable as a poll, right?
I think so.
Yeah.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad to hear that.
Perspective
bring,
of what's it
you bring meaning. Pictures? So
like I have no pictures.
The wire transfer.
No pictures. But it'll be more exciting, I promise.
Thank you.
I do have another, like, at least similar to the poll update. This is a good news update for the district. I wanted to provide some brief information, some background on some recent recoveries that we've received from legal settlements regarding municipal derivative instruments. Since 2011, various state attorneys general, as well as other municipal entities, have alleged certain financial institutions have been engaged in bid rigging of various derivative products. So essentially what the claim is that these financial institutions had colluded and predetermined ahead of time which entities would win bid transactions for these derivative instruments or which prices they would be bidding at, essentially divvying up the market. The types of derivatives products that these cases applied to were things like bond reserve investments, as well as interest rate swaps. And while none of the financial entities admitted to any wrongdoing or admitted to any of the alleged bid rigging claims that were made in the cases, they did agree to settle the claims, which is where the benefit to the district comes into place. We did enter into some of these types of agreements over previous years. The window of time that this covered was actually 1992 through 2011, so it was quite a broad window of time. And because of those settlements, we did have a right to file claims, and we did so. Between 2012 and 2017, we received multiple settlement payments from the entities, and to date, we've collected over $500,000 from those settling those claims. At this time, we don't expect any further recoveries. We do expect that is the end of this series of class action suits and settlements with attorney generals. We do plan to file a new claim on a somewhat related topic. It's also related to similar transaction types that relates to LIBOR manipulation. LIBOR is the London Interbank Offer Rate. It's set by a group of 14 or 15 international banking institutions. And there's been claims that prior to and during the financial turmoil, 2007, 8, 2009 timeframe, that these banks were getting together and deciding what rate they would set at rather than providing their independent rates. So we do plan to file a claim under that class action as well. And just like the other claims, though, it's likely that it will be years, if there is any settlement that occurs, before we would see any benefit to that. But just kind of a reassurance that we do follow these things. It is something that we try to continue to diligently look at for the best interest of our customer owners.
Thank you.
Yep. Any questions?
That is exciting. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I think so.
Yeah. Nice work.
Thanks.
Thank you. Good.
Thank you, Heather. I want to give you an update on the Bavarian substation transmission line. Remember that we picked the location for the substation, but we've been working on the routing for the transmission line. So Tika Sellers, Gary Rice will be presenting.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Tika Sellers, Customer Outreach Specialist with Customer Utilities.
And Gary Rice with Engineering Project Management, Project Manager.
So we've been here a couple times, and we just wanted to follow up with you and let you know that we've received all the public comment regarding the three alternatives for transmission routing to get transmission down into the new substation location in Leavenworth. So the feasibility analysis recommended alternative three, and the majority of all the input we received, an overwhelming majority, also recommended alternative three. So we're going to move forward with design on that, and Gary can talk a little bit about the next steps.
I was looking for the visual there.
Oh, sorry. I can bring it up really quick.
Yeah, like Tika said, we did a feasibility analysis, just a feasibility level, and we had three different routes chosen. We had a couple public meetings where we got input, and the majority of the public input was that our alternate number three was the preferred route. It's also the least costly route. The three routes that we show here, the longer the distance, essentially, the more the cost. And then there's visual impacts as well. So the shorter route is along an existing transmission corridor. It's the old railroad grade. And if we position it correctly, we can stay on PUD property and county property. Which is the way that we're intending to lay it out. And since it is within an existing transmission corridor, there's less visual impact from new homes in that area. So that's why I think it received the best public comment or the recommended public comment because it is shorter and it was the least expensive as well. So we do plan on moving forward with the transmission and substation design together so that we can put together a conditional use permit application on both at the same time. And we'll be working towards that beginning next month and with the hopes that by the end of the first quarter we would have that conditional use permit ready to submit.
Yeah, and we'll make sure that we keep this group of stakeholders updated. We'll let them know we're moving forward with this alternative. And then we've got a smaller group of stakeholders right around the substation that wanted to have some input on the design. So we'll bring back a conceptual design later this year and ask them for their input. Anything else?
No, this process went fairly smoothly with the transmission outreach. Remember, we started with the substation outreach, and then we recognized that there would be transmission impacts to bring this additional reliability to the city of Leavenworth, and I think it was well received.
So, Gary, it's the lowest turquoise line.
Yes, that's correct. I might also add that where we do tap into the line, you can see that there's an upper yellow line that taps into the upper line. That's where we will be tapping in and coming from. Transmission said that will likely be rebuilt as part of the same effort. It was due to be rebuilt in the near future anyhow. So we did communicate that with the property owners as well.
Does it change the height of that at all, Gary?
Theoretically, it shouldn't change the height of it because we don't have any distribution on it. But sometimes it changes the pole spacings. We'll look at opportunities to be able to make it more efficient or less visual impact as we do that.
And just note, too, that there's two feeds coming into the new substation. So one will be this here, and then the other will be a second route. We're calling this transmission line one. So we have been clear with the stakeholders in this area as well that that new transmission line will come along here. There's an existing distribution line, and we plan to build the transmission line in that same corridor and hang the distribution underneath, I believe. Chad?
And that'll be a taller structure, and didn't get any feedback on that?
No, we worked really hard to reach out. So these folks right in here are just property owners. So there's a new property owner for these two lots here, and then this is the city. And we've got the school district. We've reached out, and I've actually spoken with the property owner here. He's not concerned at all. He's well aware of what we're doing. I've been trying to get this property owner to give me a call because we only have mailing addresses for them because they're not current PUD customers. So I'll continue to work on that. But the business owners and the school district and people are aware of that, and we haven't received any concerns at this point in time.
That is an area also that we did have renderings made, and at several of the public meetings we showed those renderings before and after. But Tika was correct in saying that it's a new distribution line now, but it will be a rebuilt line with transmission above and distribution below.
Just a thought, you might share the name of whoever that owns that with Commissioner McKenna. He might actually know that individual with his past history with the schools up there.
Okay, yeah, I will contact you. Thank you. Any questions?
My last question is, Chad and Gary, this gives us that redundancy, the two lines coming in. Is that correct? That's what you were hoping for?
Yes, it does.
Okay. Thank you.
I can't tell you how much I appreciate all the work that you've done.
Thank you.
In the community. Lots of accolades on a very difficult situation. And really, really appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for manager items.
That's all the manager items. Commission items.
Not actually a commission item, but a grandfather report on a PUD activity. We didn't go. Our son and his wife took our granddaughter to Halloween at the Dam, or whatever it was officially called. And to give you a breakfast this morning, the 8-year-old gave us a rundown on how much fun it was. And I think the best statement was, we planned on going for an hour and stayed for 2.5.
Wow.
So it was well received, and I understand it was a great turnout. And she couldn't have had a better afternoon at a lovely fall day at a great location and wonderful activities. So congratulations to everybody who was involved in that. It was well received, at least in the eyes of 1 8-year-old, and she's pretty special, so that was big.
And just to report, I was able to attend the River of Power workshops that they do with the schools, all the fourth grades. And now I know why Bob is a legend. I watched him work with kids. He is a jewel, let me tell you. He knows what he's doing, and he's a master. But it was a great program, and I enjoyed being there with my granddaughter. It's a load of fun.
Right. You good?
Nope. I don't know if you want to share that tomorrow we'll be both leaving for Olympia. For a Waputa budget meeting.
Right.
Randy and I will be there in just a one-day meeting.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I did have just a couple of items. The first one, I received notification in the middle of last week that the nominating committee for American Public Power Association has nominated our general manager, Steve Wright, to they've put his nomination forward to the board. My understanding of the process is the board will accept the nominations or not, but generally do accept the nominations as presented by the nominating committee. And then an election will be held, I believe it's at the March meeting in Washington, D.C., when all the utilities have the opportunity to be there to vote on election of board of directors. So there's a board meeting, or there's a general membership meeting held at that meeting, if I recall correctly, late in the afternoon on one day. So you'll have to wait with bated breath for several months for whether or not you actually get elected, Steve. So
we'll see what happens.
Yeah, that's right. We will. But also, I do have in front of me, and I think all of us have in front of us, and this probably is a good time as any to do it, a need to set a couple of special meetings. The first is a special meeting for October 24th at 6 p.m. at the Chelan Fire Hall, 232 Wapato in Chelan, for the purpose of a Chelan substation public meeting. Do I hear a motion to that effect?
So moved.
Second.
Been moved and seconded to set that special meeting as forestated. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is carried. And the second is to set a special meeting November 7th at 1 p.m. at Chelan County PUD Boardroom, 327 North Wenatchee Avenue, for the purpose of holding a tri-commission meeting. Is there a motion to that effect?
So moved. Second.
Been moved and seconded. Any discussion?
What happens when you sit in the middle?
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is carried. All right. I don't believe I have any other commission items. Item 18, follow-up on delegation of action items.
We have one from the last meeting. So there was a request that we look into revenue potential for the shared radio capacity and microwave issues. And what we decided to do is we're going to look at some outreach into other potential users of the system and then get back to you in the first quarter of next year. And that's it.
Okay. And are there any actions from today?
We did not capture any. Did we miss any? Okay, good.
Is there any additional public comment? See much public left in the room? If there is not, we will take a 5-minute break and come back into executive session for approximately 2 hours to discuss with legal counsel agency enforcement actions, litigation, potential litigation to which the district or its board is or is likely to become a party, and or legal risks as authorized by the RCWs, to conduct collective bargaining sessions with employee organizations, including contract negotiations, grievance meetings, and discussions relating to the interpretation or application of a labor agreement as authorized by the RCWs, and to consider matters affecting national security, and to consider if in compliance with any required data security breach disclosure under the RCWs, and with legal counsel available, information regarding the infrastructure and security of computer and telecommunications networks, security and service recovery plans, security risk assessments, and security test results to the extent they identify specific system vulnerabilities.
Ooh.
And other information that, if made public, may increase the risk to the confidentiality, integrity, or availability of agency security or to information technology, infrastructure, or assets as authorized by the RCWs. And I want to know who wrote that sentence.
So that's the legislature. That's actually one of the most recent justifications for executive session, just recently enacted by the legislature. Apparently, they were billing by the word.
Well, that whole thing I just read.
Maybe the letter.
Sentence.
Yes, it was. So I apologize for that. We're working on an abbreviated version of that for future executive session purposes.
Would be much appreciated.
I know.
So anyway, after a 5-minute break, we'll come back.
Another 5 minutes after it took 5 minutes back.
So we've been in executive commission or executive session for the last 2 hours. We're coming out of executive session. No votes were taken. No decisions were made. Is there any additional business to come before the commission? Hearing none, we'll stand adjourned.